something?
Check, check.
Okay.
Two-minute warning, folks. Two-minute warning. Thank you. All right. Welcome, everybody. On behalf of St. Martin's and the men of St. Martin's, welcome to our second annual Spanberg Lecture. Before we dig into things, I want to begin with a word of prayer. So the Lord be with you. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, you have created each of us in your image, and you have called us to worship you. You have placed us here as citizens and sojourners in this country. And we pray, Lord, that you would give us this night wisdom and discernment and understanding for how we can follow you as your servants as we are citizens of the country in which we live. We ask your blessing upon our speaker, our speakers, and everybody here this evening. Through Christ our Lord, we pray. Amen. All right. We're so glad to have each and every one of you here. I am the Reverend Jordan Hilden. I lead up Christian education here at St. Martin's, and I'm just so excited to have Dr. Munoz and Judge Jones here tonight. We've been working on this for a while, and I think this is going to be a great event. This is the second annual Spanberg Lecture, and the series is dedicated to the memory of Ron Spanberg, family members of whom are right here up front. Mr. Spanberg was a longtime member of St. Martin's and the men's Bible study. Ron loved his family, his country, and his Lord, and he was concerned, as many of us are, about the divisions and turmoil that we have experienced in recent years as Americans. And so he and some of his men's Bible study friends started this lecture series as a way of reminding us of the fundamental principles of American democracy and civic life, and to help us see the important contribution that Christian faith and values have historically made to that democratic project, so that we, as followers of Jesus, can be better equipped to contribute to our civic life today. Our first speaker was the well-known historian Tom Holland, he of the Rest is History podcast, whose book Dominion is a landmark exploration of how the witness and teaching of Jesus Christ laid the foundation for much of the values we take for granted in the Western world. This evening, we are thrilled to have as our keynote lecturer Dr. Vincent Philip Munoz. He is the Tocqueville Professor of Political Science. I love that title, by the way, because I love Tocqueville, at the University of Notre Dame, where he is the founding director of the Center for Citizenship and Constitutional Government. Professor Munoz writes and teaches across the fields of constitutional law, American politics, and political philosophy with a focus on religious liberty and the American founding. He won a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship to support his most recent book, Religious Liberty and the American Founding, Natural Rights and the Original Meanings of the First Amendment Religion Clauses. I also highly recommend his first book with a shorter title, God and the Founders, Madison, Washington, and Jefferson. They're both over there for sale tonight. Dr. Munoz is currently serving as a distinguished visiting professor at the School of Civic Leadership at UT Austin, and his lecture will be followed by a response and then a conversation with the Honorable Edith Jones, who has served since 1985 as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. That's how the legal world knows her, but St. Martin's members may know her better as a member of the vestry and of the choir. After Dr. Munoz's lecture and a response by Judge Jones, we're going to be taking questions from the audience. And I want to say a little bit about how that's going to work. If you want to ask a question, we have cards available. If you haven't got one, you can go get one. And as something strikes you during the talk, write something down, okay? And then after the talk and the response, we're going to invite you to hand them in to the center aisle. And Julie is going to collect them, and she's going to hand them up to me, and then I'll ask questions that way at the end, after our talk and response for our conversation. So that's how that's going to work. So if you want to ask a question, and we encourage you to, write down your questions that way. One last word before I get off the stage. This lecture series has been made possible by the late Ron Spanberg and his Bible study friends, and if you like what we're up to, please do consider giving generously to our ongoing work. This lecture series is not funded by our regular church budget, so it's all made possible by your support. There are envelopes for your donation if you feel called to make one this evening, and we would also love to hear your ideas for future speakers in this series. That's it for me. You didn't come to hear from me. So let's give a warm welcome to our guest tonight, Dr. Vincent Philip Munoz.
Thanks so much. Good evening. Thank you for giving me part of your Wednesday evening. Thank you to Reverend Hilden, Jim McCullough, thank you very much for the invitation, for all those who made it possible, and especially to the Sponger family. It's a great honor for me to be here. I hope this lecture does service to Mr. Sponberg. Claire, you will tell me, okay, if I've done a good job. Let me thank Judge Jones. It's an honor and terrifying to share the stage with her, as you might imagine. But thank you. She is one of our country's most distinguished patriots, and she's an honor. She is a hero of mine. So it's truly an honor to be on the stage with her. I want to begin by actually thanking the entire community. We don't know each other well, but you, this community has actually already given me a great blessing. When Jim called me and we started to set this up late last year, I was slow in responding to finalizing the dates. And one of the reasons I was slow is my son had some medical issues and involved a sudden trip to Chicago, Children's Hospital in Chicago overnight, and it was not looking good at one moment in time. And for some reason, I got to call Jim back. He's been waiting for this email, so I called him and I apologized, and I said my son's in the hospital in Chicago, and we're worried. And actually, it was an email I sent you. And I got an email back the next day from Jim saying, the entire St. Martin's community is praying for you. And that meant so much to me. And I felt those prayers. And I've been so eager to come back and say thank you. My son is actually in the room right behind those doors. He'd be furious if he knew I mentioned him. He's doing well, so well that the last thing he wants to do is hear his father lecture. I feel like I'm a part of this community, and I'm so happy to be a part of the community. So thank you very much. Okay, let me see if I can give my talk now. I've titled the talk, Why Do We Separate Church from State? I have a confession to make here. This is the first time I've given this talk. So we'll see how it goes. I have another confession to make. I was going to practice this afternoon, but I went to the Astros game instead. Yeah. It's even worse. We rooted for Detroit. So I don't know how long it's going to take. So if you want to text those babysitters right now, say you might be a little late, but we'll see how it goes, okay? I wanted to try to present something new to this community, okay? So this is this is my son here, and this is actually Easter morning, my three kids, yeah. Okay, this is what we're going to try to do tonight, hopefully in a timely manner. The talk is in three parts. In parts one and two, I'm going to present what I think are the two leading competing visions of the separation of church and state and religious freedom in America today. I'm going to start in part one with the liberal or progressive approach. The fundamentals of the progressive approach were authored in the mid-20th century in a number of Supreme Court decisions. They continue today in the jurisprudence of Justice Sotomayor in particular, but in others as well. I'll refer to this as the wall of separation approach. In part two of the talk, I'm going to turn to the founders. Now, I just want to confess, the founders are complicated. I wrote a book explaining how they disagree, but I'm going to try to focus on their core agreements. I'm going to call their approach the natural rights or the limited government approach. And then in the third part of the talk, which is really not a separate part, just a conclusion, I'm going to say a few brief remarks about a few of my thoughts about Christianity and religious freedom. Now, for this part of this talk, I just want to say it now, feel completely inadequate, because I'm actually going to talk a little bit about a biblical quote. You should know, I'm Catholic. It's not clear to me I'm allowed to read the Bible. So, I just want to put that out there. So I'm going to offer a few of my thoughts about the biblical foundations about what I'm talking about. If I'm successful in this talk, and Claire's going to be the judge of that, this is what I hope you will take away from it. That you'll understand how the progressive approach departs from the founder's approach. Secondly, I'm going to make the argument that the founder's approach is consonant with Christianity, but it's not quite right to say that we have a Christian founding. I'm going to try to explain that point. I'm also going to try to show how religion, especially Christianity, is an essential element of the American experiment in liberal democracy, but the role of religion and religious authority is distinct from political authority. My thesis, in a nutshell, is that there are biblical reasons for the separation of church and state, that properly understood, the distinction between the authorities of church and state are meant to secure religious freedom, and religious freedom is necessary to facilitate the worship and love of God according to conviction and conscience. Okay, it's a lot to do in one talk. I'm going to try to focus on what I think are the most essential elements. So I am basically presenting 8 weeks of course material in the next 35 minutes. And it is actually very interesting for me to sit back and, okay, how can I do that in a coherent way, hopefully, in an interesting way? And this is the new part, so I really haven't done this before. I'm going to focus on what I think are four of the most essential things. And you tell me if this works. I'm going to focus on what I think are the fundamental facts, the fundamental starting points that the progressives start with, and then alternatively with the founders. So that's the first thing, fundamental facts. Second thing is those facts lead to a teaching about authority, political authority and religious authority. So first facts, then teaching about authority. That teaching, those facts and teachings about authority lead to what I'm going to call a constitutional politics, an approach to church and state. And then underneath it all is an understanding of human freedom. Right? And what we're going to see is there are competing visions or competing understandings of human freedoms. Right? So facts, authority, politics, constitutional politics, and freedom. Okay. And I think this is going to work, but you can tell me. One other sort of caveat. I'm pretty conservative. I study the founders in part because I think we live in the greatest country on earth. I think it's a blessing to be American, and I love the political architecture that the founders left to us. But I'm not here to convince you that the progressives are bad and the founders are good, or vice versa. I don't do that with my students. I wouldn't even presume to do that with you. I understand my task, or I set for myself the task of, I'm going to try to present these competing views, and you decide for yourself the side that you think better articulates it, okay? But I want to tell you, I'm a partisan of the founders, but I'm not trying to convince you to agree with me, right? You judge for yourself. Okay, so let's start with the progressives. Okay, this is a quote from the first Establishment Clause case, when the courts set up the wall of separation interpretation of the First Amendment. And I'll read this to you, okay? Now, the context here is the Supreme Court has never said what the First Amendment means. We're talking about the First Amendment. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment. This is the story the court says. Let me just read it to you. A large portion of the earth, of the earthly settlers of this country, came here from Europe to escape the bondage of laws which compelled them to support and attend government-favored churches. Centuries immediately before and contemporaneous with the colonization of America had been filled with turmoil, civil strife, and persecution, generated in large part by established sects determined to maintain their absolute political and religious supremacy. Right? Protestants persecuted Catholics, Catholics persecuted Protestants, everyone persecuted the Jews. That's the first fundamental fact of the progressive story. Right? Religion and religious authority have a persecuting spirit. Religion, when coupled with political authority, can be deadly. That's where the progressives start from. Okay, so those are the key first facts. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead to another case. Lemon v. Kurtzman, 1971. In a way, this is the most important or the leading wall of separation case. The facts of this case, the details that lead to it, are actually really interesting. So the case comes from Rhode Island. And this is in the 1970s, early 1970s. So Rhode Island is a relatively Catholic state. Lots of Catholic schools, at least, I think that's actually still true today, but certainly in the 60s. What's going on in the Catholic schools in the 60s? Right. Claire? No, okay. So, you know, lots of priests are leaving. Lots of nuns are leaving the Catholic Church. So who's teaching in these Catholic schools? Right? I mean, why were Catholic schools, especially back in the 50s and 60s, so good? The teachers are nuns, right, who today are lawyers and doctors and principals, and judges. And so, and what are they paid? Almost nothing. So you have a phenomenally well-educated group of teachers who you pay nothing. This is an administrator's dream, right? And so lots of these nuns and priests, too, start leaving the Catholic Church, and this decimates the Catholic schools. So the Rhode Island legislature says, look, we have a crisis in education in Rhode Island because so many kids go to Catholic schools. And so the state legislature passes a salary supplement program. And to simplify the details, it's basically like, if you teach in a private school, and 95% of the private schools are Catholic, if you teach in a private school and use the same math books or science books or STEM books, we'd say now, that they use in the public schools, and your teachers, you don't pay the teachers any more than a public school teacher makes, the state of Rhode Island will give those teachers a 15% salary supplement. So you got to use the same books, they got to teach math and science, and the private school teachers can't make more than the public school teachers. That's the basic program. And it goes up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court strikes it down as, that's unconstitutional. Now, what I want to focus on is why. And this is a passage from the Supreme Court's reasoning, right? And let me read just a bit of it to you. It said, partisans of parochial schools, understandably concerned with the rising costs and sincerely dedicated to both religious and secular education mission of the schools, will inevitably champion this cause. Those opposed will take the other side. Right? The court says, it'd be unrealistic to ignore the fact that many people confronted with issues of this kind will find their votes aligned with their faith. Step back and say, isn't that what we call democracy? I mean, it's an interesting public question, right? Okay, should we use taxpayer money to fund these private schools that are mostly Catholic? Reasonable people can disagree. And we say, well, that's what, you know, so that's, you know, before we had the Department of Education, that's what we did in local communities in our states. Here's what the court next says. Ordinarily, political debate and division, however vigorous or even partisan, are normal and healthy manifestations of our democratic system of government. But political division along religious lines was one of the principal evils which the First Amendment was intended to protect against. The political divisiveness of such conflict is a threat to the normal political process. So what is the court saying here? This subject, because it involves religion, can be so dangerous, we're not going to let you, the people, vote on it. And we're going to decide it for you, and we're going to say no government money, no taxpayer money to private schools, to Catholic schools, to religious schools. Because you can't handle that division. Why can't you handle that? Because that first fundamental fact, religion by its nature is so divisive. Do you see how that fundamental fact leads to that result? Okay. So the court said religious schools must be excluded from programs of state funding because if they're included, that might cause too much division in society. The fundamental facts that religion is divisive and dangerous is the starting point of the progressive approach to the separation of church and state. The solution is the wall of separation. What does the wall of separation mean? It means wherever we're in the public square, religion must be excluded. Right. We see this particularly in school cases. And you can see it most clearly in prayer in public school cases. Okay, this is a case, I'm going back in time here, this is from the 1960s. This is, I gave, not this lecture, but a different lecture, and I mentioned this case in New York a few years ago, and I had a lady in the back, like, I said this prayer, a Jewish lady in the back. This is called the Regent's Prayer. And this is a prayer written by the Regents, that is the school board in New York, that every New York school child said up until 1962. Right. The Supreme Court strikes it down in 1962 because of the wall of separation between church and state. 30 years later, in 1992, the Supreme Court hears another case called Lee versus Weissman. This is the benediction that a Jewish rabbi said at the beginning of a middle school graduation. And so the question before the court is, can... Now, in 1962, the kids were asked to stand and recite the prayer. In 1992, this is a middle school graduation. They're just there. And a Jewish rabbi is up on the stage, and he recites this prayer, which he wrote. So in 1992, it is, can kids be asked to listen to a prayer? And what does the Supreme Court say? Unconstitutional. Students might feel psychologically coerced by being asked to stand while a prayer is said. So how does that make sense? What is the worldview that leads to that conclusion? Right? Well, first, religion is divisive. That means a wall of separation. That means religion must be excluded. But why is all that good? And this brings us to the understanding of human freedom. Right? This is from not from a church-state case. This is a quote from Planned Parenthood versus Casey. But it gets to the essence of the progressive understanding of freedom. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life. Human freedom for progressives lies in creating meaning for oneself. Religious freedom means creating meaning about God or ultimate concerns, and then living authentically in light of that meaning, in light of one's own deeply held beliefs. Such a belief may be associated with religion, even traditional religion. They may involve a higher power, but they are socially understood. They're understood in the progressive mind as rooted in oneself. Right? So religious authority in the progressive view, especially traditional religious authority, stands in tension with this understanding of freedom. I think maybe I shouldn't do this, but think of how a progressive school district deals with the issue of transgenderism. Right? A kid identifies differently than the gender they're born with. In some progressive schools, they won't tell the parents. Why not? Again, I'm not trying to say this is right or wrong. Just what is the worldview that leads you to say we need to protect this child from the child's, from her parents? And it's a worldview that says freedom is found in living according to one's authentic self, which is found inside of oneself. And therefore, traditional authorities, especially religious authority, even parental authority, are a barrier to freedom. Do you see how the argument goes? And how, why religious authority in this worldview needs to be excluded, especially around children? The public schools, in this sense, are a prophylactic against traditional authority, religious authority. Okay. To be free in the progressive worldview, one can't be influenced by an authoritative tradition, especially when one's young. So children must be shielded. That's why you exclude prayer from public school. Right? To not do so would be to stunt one's moral freedom. I should be clear. I don't want to suggest that the progressive view is necessarily hostile to religion. If you choose it for yourself as your commitment when you're an adult, that is perfectly fine. That can be an authentic expression of human freedom. So please don't misinterpret me to saying the progressive view is hostile to religion. That's not its self-understanding. I'm trying to present its self-understanding. But especially around children, we have to have the wall of separation. Okay? Relatively clear? Okay. Let me, so this is my summary slide here. Right. Moral autonomy is meant to, this is a term that academics use all the time. Where do you find morality? Where do you find truth? Where do you find meaning? By turning inward, into yourself. Someone, when I was signing books, someone mentioned Rousseau. Rousseau is the leading intellect. It's a combination of Rousseau and Freud. Are the intellectual influences here? Okay, this is a serious intellectual tradition. Okay, let me move on to the founder's approach. Again, just as I did with the progressives, I'm going to try to simplify. The founders are complicated. They don't speak with a single voice. Much of what I've just said about the founders could be attributed to Thomas Jefferson. Right? He's sort of the villain of my book, just so to give it away. But he was very much of the founders. He was the progressive founder, right? Nonetheless, I think George Washington and James Madison, especially George Washington, speak for the founding generation, for the common sense understanding of most of the founders. This is a paragraph of George Washington's letter to the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island. It's only four paragraphs, so you have more than a fourth of it right here. I think it's actually one of the most important letters and one of the most beautiful letters in all of American history. Let me just read you, I highlighted it there, right? Now, remember, it's 1790 and he's writing to the Jews. He says, All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. The first fundamental fact for the founders is that all individuals have a natural right to religious freedom. The right is natural, or Washington says inherent, meaning that it inheres in our nature. That, in other words, our right to religious freedom doesn't come from the state, it doesn't come from government. Our rights are endowed by the Creator. They inhere in our human nature. A good government, a just government, recognizes our natural rights. But the important point here is rights do not come from the government. They're part of our created nature. Okay? That we have rights by nature is the first fundamental fact. The second fundamental fact from the founders, and I take this from James Madison, is that we have a right to religious freedom because we have a duty to worship God.
Right.
In fact, really, the first fact is we have a duty to worship, and it's a duty to worship in conviction and according to conscience. That is the bedrock fact. Because we have a duty to worship, we have a right among our fellow men to do so. Okay. So the two fundamental facts from the founders. Can you start to see the difference already? Okay. To say that one has a right to worship freely means that government cannot prohibit or legitimately cannot prohibit or interfere with religious worship. In terms of authority, the facts of our duties to God and that we ought to worship freely means that political authority must be limited. We the people do not give government authority to control our religious opinion. So the next thing was authority. So the facts, duty to worship, freedom to do so, what does that mean for authority? It means we limit authority, right? So we give lots of authority to government. That's the circle on the left. But we don't give all authority to government, right? So the circles overlap. There's dual authorities in some things. But what's on the right, that part of the sphere, that there are some things government just simply can't do. And let me give you an example. Who in here has a license, a professional license of some sort? Medical license, law license, accounting license, right? Okay, so the people who, the underemployed don't have their hands up, yeah, right? All right. I don't have a license from the government because anyone can be a college professor. like I can't teach kindergarten, okay? I mean, to cut hair, you have to have a cosmetology license. Almost most professions nowadays, you have to have a license, right? Okay. Reverend, do you have a preaching license from the state of Texas? Right? Why does the state of Texas or any state, why do we say, what would happen if the state of Texas, let's be more realistic, what would happen if the state of California said, we're going to start licensing preachers? What would we say? You're saying no. Why no? And the answer is because we the people never gave you that authority. That's what I mean by the founder's understanding of authority is the state's authority, the government authority is limited. There are some things the state simply does not have authority to do. I heard someone say, you know, the bishop, right, has authority, right? Does the state have authority to appoint bishops? And we say no, because we the people, when we set up the Constitution, never gave the government that authority. Why do we not give the government that authority? Because that authority belongs to churches, and the churches get their authority from God, not from the state. So the fundamental fact of our duty to worship God has a teaching about authority. In this case, political authority is limited. Okay, what about that other sphere where we do give authority? How should the state treat churches and treat religious individuals? Remember, in the progressive view, it was exclusion or marginalization. We can go back to Washington's letter, but here, just think about the context. It's 1790. George Washington is writing to the Jews. George Washington knows everything he's doing will set a precedent. And so he writes this letter to the Jews, and he's writing to all of America. He's writing to you children today. And what Washington is doing is saying, America, this is the land for every lover of freedom. Jews and Gentiles alike. And he's telling the Jews, and he's telling everyone, all of us, right? You are an equal citizen. Your country will ask some things of you, but it won't ask everything. It won't tell you how to worship. It will just ask you to be a good citizen. And in that realm of political authority, it will treat you equally. So equality, not exclusion, is the founder's teaching about how we treat religion and religious people in the sphere of political authority. Okay, make sense? Okay, so fixed limits, this is the teaching on authority, fixed limits, and then, so there's some things government can't do. Where government can operate, religious citizens are treated equally as non-religious citizens. And Catholics are treated the same as Protestants, and the Jews are treated the same as everyone else. Okay, that's the constitutional politics. What's the understanding of freedom behind this? Now, this is a little bit harder to tease out. But the understanding of freedom is, who's responsible for worshiping God? Well, you are. The founder's understanding of freedom is one of individual responsibility. The leading virtue of a liberal democracy is responsibility, being responsible for yourself, governing yourself, doing the things you ought to do, right? Providing for your children, providing a good family life, being responsible where you can for your community. But you have duties to God, but the state's not going to tell you how to perform them, right? You see how this also carves out space for the church. The primary duty of the state is to get out of the way so church authorities can do their work. So when I say responsibility or individual responsibility, I mean churches have, the reverend has his work to do too. Okay, so the understanding of freedom is not self-determination or moral autonomy, but of responsibility. And by that, doing what you ought to do. Okay, so my quick summary slide there. I skipped one part. Let me just illustrate the difference. How would the founders have dealt with that Rhode Island program? Well, presumably, they would have said, and this was before the Supreme Court today, look, if the state of Rhode Island passes legislation that says we're going to help private schools teach math and science, religious schools should be treated no worse and no better than any other religious school or any other private school, right? Or if a church funds a 12-step program, right? I mean, if you're the state, what are you concerned about? Well, is the program effective? And if the religious program is effective, then it can be funded. If it's not effective, then you have whatever criteria you measure to effectiveness. I mean, you don't get the money because you're religious, but you're not excluded because you're religious. Right. It's actually a relatively simple principle. Okay. All right. Okay. Let me start to wrap up here. This is where I start to get nervous. Sorry. Okay. At the beginning of the talk, I said I wanted to try to do three things. How the liberal approach departs from the founder's approach. I hope that's relatively clear. Okay. Secondly, I said that the founder's approach is consonant with Christianity, but it's not quite right to say that we have a Christian founding. Let me try to, this is just my summary slide of what we've done before, comparing the two. But hopefully I've made this clear enough already. Sorry, I go through this quickly, but just what we've been saying. But I'm eager to get to the Bible here. This is from Mark 12. I kid you not, whenever I quote the Bible at Notre Dame, I always ask if is there a Protestant student in the class? And without fail, right, if they don't know the quote, they know where it's at. And the Catholic students are all like, how'd you know that? Without fail. Okay. You know this passage. I don't need to read this. Now, I don't know what church tradition... I'm a political scientist. Let me just make this clear. I have no idea what church tradition teaches about this passage. So this is you're just getting a Notre Dame political scientist. But it seems to me Jesus is teaching two things. The first is, he says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Jesus is not an anarchist. He's not throw off the state. It seems to me he's saying state authority is legitimate, but it's also limited because he says give to God what is God's. And it seems to me he's saying in some way that the state's authority isn't, the state is not speaking with divine authority. I'm happy to be corrected by secular or religious authorities afterward. But isn't he saying the state is limited? The state is legitimate, but limited. That, I think, is the foundation of the separation of church and state. But Jesus doesn't say much more about politics. He seems to counsel, yes, there's legitimate state authorities, and those authorities must be limited. He doesn't tell us set up a constitutional republic with the separation of powers and an independent judiciary with life tenure. Right? Maybe. But I don't think it's there. That's what we have to figure out. But we have to figure it out with leaving to God what is God's. I bring this up because I think this is where the foundation of the separation of church and state is. And America is not perfect, but I think our approach is consonant with the Bible. Other approaches might also be consonant with the Bible, because the Bible, it seems to me, leaves wide latitude for how we set up our government. But as long as we recognize some authority and limit it. And this is what I mean by when I say America, it's not quite right, I think, to say America is a Christian nation. But it is certainly right to say it's consonant with Christianity. And I guess one of my worries about when we say it's a Christian nation, I think, but what about George Washington's letter to the Jews? Because it's their nation too. And it always has been. So a nation that is perfectly compatible with the Gospels, and I don't know if consonant is the right language, but that's the best I've been able to come up with. Okay. Let me conclude here. This is just what I just said. In my belief, the greatness of America is that our country recognizes our rightful freedom to worship according to conscience. But America doesn't tell us how to worship. And I guess this is my last point. That's why we need church authority. You know, we love liberty, as we rightfully should, especially here in Texas, which I love this state. Right? We should be partisans of liberty. But we still need to live well. I mean, freedom can't be the ultimate goal. And this is why Christianity or religion is part of the American experiment. We need the state to help secure our freedom. But we need our churches to help us use that freedom well. And this is how the spirit of liberty and the spirit of religion must go hand in hand. Right? America was made for a religious people. I mean, that's not my saying. That's Washington saying. That's Tocqueville saying. But this is what they meant. Because freedom alone is not enough. So we should be thankful for our freedom, but always remember that our duty is not just to live freely, but to live well. And ultimately, our freedom is so we can love and serve the Lord. Government can't make us do that. And we should not expect it or want it to try to make us do that. But that we have freedom in America to love and serve the Lord is a great blessing, It's why I'm so thankful to be American. It's why I have devoted my professional life to teaching these principles. I hope this brief lecture has been helpful to you to understand some of those principles. And it's a great blessing for me to be with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, I hope the mic works. Thank you very much, Reverend Jordan, for inviting me to make remarks. It was purely coincidental that I found out that he was inviting my friend to speak here. I didn't intend to be on the podium tonight, so I'll just see what transpires here. But fortunately, I had the outline to begin with. I thank the family here tonight for endowing this lecture. I agree with the rectors and the priests of St. Martin's that Christian education is one of the most important things we can do, and learning about the origins of our religious freedom is one of the most important things, and unfortunately a very neglected subject nowadays. So I suggest you buy his book and read up on the subject, because we all need to be informed as citizens. This is not what he's talking about are not new issues, but the way in which he presents them is brilliant for a non-legal audience and a non-political science audience. What you see here is that what I would call, I'm not as genteel as Professor Munoz, what you see here is a full-throated challenge to religion that started in philosophical terms quite a long time ago, but was brought to the fore by the U.S. Supreme Court, as you see from the 1947 opinion in Everson, which talked about the wall of separation. And just a historical footnote, that term was used by Thomas Jefferson in a letter that he wrote to the Danbury Baptists long after he had been president, and whether that had any claim to any legal grounding for the First Amendment is highly dubious. But that is the principle on which the Supreme Court has issued a whole bunch of very complicated and, in my view, many unfortunate rulings for a period of about 70 years. One of the opinions that he put up on the board was Lee versus Weissman, one of the most embarrassing of my attempts to give speeches experience came in 1992 when I addressed an audience and I said, you know, I think the Supreme Court is about to roll back their condemnation of speeches of prayer in public schools, because after all, it was a graduation ceremony where kids did not have to participate. They could have walked out of the room. It was given by a Jewish rabbi. And 2 days later, the court came out in Lee v. Weissman and said it was unconstitutional. And that's why I never predict the Supreme Court anymore. I have just a couple brief remarks so we can move on to questions. What Professor Munoz didn't mention that was in his outline was that he personally thinks that the school prayer cases were decided correctly. And I take issue with that. And I take issue for much the reason that he articulated at the conclusion of his remarks. Since the 1950s in public education in the United States, religion has been totally excluded. the whole idea of religious belief has been treated as if it was meaningless, totally up to an individual and not worthy of consideration. Sort of like that food that sits at the back of the refrigerator and someday you'll pull it out and see if it's at a sell-by date yet. It's very, very unfortunate, and it creates an atmosphere in which people who don't go to church regularly, whose parents are not church, grow up with the impression that religion isn't significant. So I bring you back to another part of Washington's farewell address that's very famous. This is when he was leaving the presidency. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports, the firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. And I would say, Thomas Jefferson probably included, that the founders knew that you cannot have a self-governing people unless they are people of virtue. And they also concluded you cannot have virtue without morality, and you can't have morality without religion. And that was their view, and I do not see why the public schools cannot teach about religion. In fact, back in the ancient days when I was in high school, we read the book of Job in English class. The ways of God are inscrutable according, you know, to the conclusion of Job, but God is all-powerful. But you didn't have to agree with it. It's great literature nonetheless. And I'd ask rhetorically, what's wrong with the Regent's Prayer as far as that goes? You know, thank you, God. We ask for your blessings on us and our students and everybody here. What's wrong with that? Do kids have to listen? Do the Buddhists mind if everyone else prays to God? Can the Muslims disagree with that? You could even say salam aleikum if you wanted to at the end of it occasionally. So that ought to provide something for us to talk about. And thank you very much. And it's an honor and pleasure to be on the podium with you.
I need a buffer from the judge.
Oh.
All right, I'm not the star of this show, but I'm going to ask the first question. And as a reminder, if anybody has a question, if you have something, pass your sheet of paper down. There's Julie. She's going to be collecting them. And I'm going to ask the first question just to give you a chance to hand in your questions, and then I'll ask them to these two here. And first of all, thank you all so much for these excellent remarks. I think we've learned a lot. So, my question, I feel a little funny. You quoted the Bible to Protestants as a Catholic, and I'm gonna as a Protestant try to quote the Pope to a Notre Dame professor. And I don't know if either one makes any sense, but I'm gonna try. So Romans 13:1, I will start with the Bible, says there's no authority except that which God has established. And historically, of course, the Roman Catholic Church, but also the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, going back to the Church of England, was an established church. In England, it is still today, in a sense, an established church with anointed monarchs. And as I read the social thought of the popes in the 19th century, they were really concerned that Americans in particular, but also the French, thought that authority was simply a bottom-up affair. We as individuals, and this is Locke and so on, we as individuals, our authority comes from me, and we contract together to tell the government to do what we want the government to do. So really, every individual is a king. And so the popes thought, well, that means that you're not really viewing authority as a gift from God. And that's also going to undercut the understanding of authority from God in the church and in every other facet of your life. So it's going to lead to the kinds of criticisms that I heard you making of the, you know, the longstanding progressive legal tradition. So they would say that the established church, this is, you know, these old Catholics and Anglicans, is a good thing because it's a bulwark against all of that. We should have it as so that we have a sense of a higher authority and a higher law. And as you know, we chatted about this in the podcast, there's a revived school of thought today in figures, post-liberal figures like Patrick Deneen, C.C. Pecknold, and Adrian Vermeule at Harvard Law School who are trying to recover some of this. So I wanted to hear both what you think the founders would say to that, and also, as far as you feel equipped to say, what you think you would say to that as a Catholic.
I mean, so we have Romans 13, 19th century papacy, and today's post-liberals. I mean, these are big issues, but the most important ones. I mean, you're right at the heart of the matter. Let me start with the 19th century popes. I hope I won't be struck down for saying this, but one could write a very long book on irresponsible papal rhetoric. And the last chapter would be very, very long on the contemporary, the last pope. My understanding of the 19th century popes, what they were most leery of and criticizing was the idea that there is no authority above the people. So there's an understanding of democracy, and this is really the French Revolution, not the American Revolution, that we say we the people, but does that mean we can do anything? That there's no authority above our will, our collective will as a people? This was the issue of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, if I can go back, go to a different story. So the issue, so this is Stephen Douglas, right? And the question is, between Lincoln and Douglas, is should the federal government outlaw slavery in the territories? And Stephen Douglas says, let the people decide. The people decide everything, Stephen Douglas says. The people decide if the African American is a man. Do people want to say he's a man? They can say he's a man. If they want him to be a slave, they can say he's a slave. Stephen Douglas is the first pro-choice politician. And Lincoln says, that's not true democracy. The people don't get to decide who is and who is not a man, a human being. Well, who does? And Lincoln's answer, nature. Nature as created by God. We, the people, have no authority to say the black man is not a man. Lincoln says, that's tyranny. So that's what I think the popes were worried about, the idea that there's no authority above the people. That is the French understanding of rights. That's not the American understanding of rights, that rights are grounded in nature and endowed by the Creator. Okay. Now, what about established churches? Now, the founders said they were creating a new order for the ages, right? And Madison, now, I loved the judge's formulation, which is Washington and Tocqueville. Self-government requires morality. Democratic government requires morality. Morality requires religion. Therefore, democratic government requires religion. But the founders said one other thing, too. Religion doesn't require government. Religion doesn't require government. And in a way, that is the foundation of their critique of established churches. Think of early Christianity. not a favorite child of the state. And that's an experiment. I mean, the great experiment to bring things now to the post-liberals, I mean, the great question of our time is, can we, the American people, be a moral people? Can we respect the authority of the natural law? Do we the people, see we can't do everything legitimately? Isn't every fundamental moral question in our society, in one way or another, is a version of that question? Are we the masters, and we get to decide, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, because I get to decide when life begins. It will begin when it's convenient for me. Or is there a moral law that we must respect? What the post-liberals, and these guys are all my friends, are saying, they say there is a moral law, and we need an authority to teach that and enforce that, legislate that for us. Right? That is at the heart of the argument for an establishment. We need an authority on earth to impose that moral law. The founders' experiment was to say, yes, there is a moral law. It's an experiment because it requires every generation of Americans to recognize it and then to limit themselves accordingly. And we've been failing in some ways from the beginning. That was our failure with slavery. And we continue to fail and fail. But we have the resources in our tradition, as with slavery, to stop failing. But it's up to us. The other part of the answer is, every time you establish an authority to impose what is right, that authority gets corrupted. Now, there's no better historical example of this than the Catholic Church. It's been a great, in my opinion, blessing for the Catholic Church to be relieved of its political authorities. The Church can teach it the Gospels with greater purity when you're not running and creating laws, I think. I think history has borne that out.
I'm not going to add to that.
Thank you. All right. A bunch of questions from the audience. All right. Regarding the presumption of constitutionality in matters longstanding with roots existing in the founders' era, how can we argue against scripture in public schools when the first textbook, the New England Primer, leans so heavily on scripture as the tool to learn reading, and Thomas Jefferson's work establishing the federal public school requiring the Bible to be in the curriculum?
Okay, good. Is that clicker still available? I want to go back.
Yeah.
The judge is right. I left out part of my remarks. I wanted to not go too long, but I kind of put some things in to provoke her. So. So this is I think teaching scripture in public school is fine. I mean, I think there's no
Justice
problem.
Justice Goldberg said that in one of the school prayer cases.
I mean, not in Catholic schools, but in other schools, it's fine. Okay. So the two circles, the political authority and religious authority. So if it wasn't clear, the judge is kind of poking me. She's saying, hey, you criticize those progressive prayer in public school cases, but you actually agree with the result, don't you? I mean, I don't know if you caught that, but that's what... And I do. What she was saying is, what's up with that? Like, why do you agree with those results? See the red circle, religious authority? My argument is, so public schools are part of political authority. There are some things we don't give to the political authority. There are some things, I don't think the regents have authority to write prayers for school children. The reverend has that authority, but it's not part of the government's authority. So it's not because, the reasons are different from the, it's not because you have to shield children from religion. Because that's his authority, not the state's authority. So how would I do the graduation case? I mean, in my world, if we understood that, look, we're not going to have the principal read a prayer, but you know what we can do is before graduation, separate from the official school ceremony, that all the members of faith in that community will have a prayer breakfast or a ceremony conducted by religious authorities. And we would know that we should do that because, one, it's important when we have these milestones that religion be a part of it. But religion belongs to religious authority. That's actually what we do on college campuses. So I live right by the UT campus. And like surrounding the campus are churches. They're next to campus. They're not owned by the university, public university. That's the best relationship between church and state. The state getting out of the way, making space, but the state not acting like a church. So that's why I actually think the prayer in public school cases were correct, but for totally different reasons. Okay, it's a close call. I mean, it's a close call. And history, now to get back to the question, I mean, history here is more on the judge's side than my side, you know. But James Madison did agree with me, I'll just say that. But George Washington agreed with the...
And Jefferson held religious ceremonies in the Congress,
right?
Despite his complaints.
Yeah, yeah. Who knows what they did at those religious ceremonies, but it is true. It is true, yeah. So, this is one of the difficulties of actually appealing to history. I mean, there's different... So I actually think we should try to reason through these things. But our tradition, I will say, just to be clear... Our tradition is one of cooperation.
What you and I might agree on is that maybe the court shouldn't decide it. Maybe local polities should be able to decide.
This also gets back to federalism. It would be so much better if local communities ran their own graduations. The fact that Supreme Court justices are saying what should be done at a middle school graduation, on its face, is just absurd. I'm almost certain in almost every political community that graduation ceremonies that reflected the mores of the local community, no one would complain.
No, we agreed.
All right. I have two questions here that are about the charter school argument today, but then also... education savings accounts, e.g. vouchers, as they're sometimes called. So one question had to do, asked, with Kurtzman v. Lemon ruling no government money to Christian schools, how will the school vouchers that are happening today, be implemented in Catholic schools? I think the question's trying to get at, you know, how is this constitutional?
Sure, sure.
And then the other question is today, so the vouchers, but then the charter school argument today, which is a slightly different issue. So help us understand, as you understand the founders and the Constitution, how we should think about these pressing arguments.
Yeah. Are you allowed to talk about the case at the court today, or should you?
I didn't hear it, so I'm a little reluctant to speak about things when I don't know exactly. Okay. What was going on?
Okay, so there's a huge Supreme Court case today. Oral arguments this morning or this afternoon. No, I didn't listen to those. I was at the Astros game, so I didn't listen. I didn't listen to the arguments, and I only saw the New York Times headline, which I didn't believe anyway. So, I know nothing about what happened today at the court. Just to be clear about that, I strongly suspect that the Supreme Court's going to uphold it's an Oklahoma program as constitutional.
Justice Barrett was recused.
But I still think they're going to uphold it. And the argument, which I think is going to be persuaded, I'm going to do exactly what the judge says you shouldn't do, is the let me back up. The Lemon precedent has been abandoned. They didn't overturn it. They just abandoned it. Someone said, what's the difference? I have no idea. Like, why didn't they just overturn it?
They can't admit they're wrong.
Yeah.
They can say we're wrong, but they're never wrong.
When the court said in 2022 about Lemon versus precedent, we've abandoned that. But that's not a that's not a legal term. The Supreme Court is supposed to say that's no longer good law. That precedent is overturned. So they seem to overturn it without overturning. It's very confusing. Lemon is the wall of separation case, the Rhode Island case. That was so in Lemon from basically 1947 until somewhere between 2005 and 2022, the First Amendment was understood to be a wall of separation. And starting in about 2005, the court chipped away at that slowly and slowly, and then they abandoned the wall of separation, though they didn't overturn it 3 years ago. So right now, no one knows what the First Amendment means. And this case we have today is maybe going to tell us a little bit more. What the court has said in recent cases is, if you have a program of funding, including private schools, if you fund some private schools, you can't exclude the religious schools. Right. That is, you agree with that, right?
Yep.
That seems to be the direction where the court is going. I think they're going to rely on that line of argumentation. If you have a program of charter schools, you can't single out the religious schools to exclude them. I think that's where they're going to go. We'll find out.
I did see an op-ed. I'd be interested in your observation. I saw an op-ed today from somebody who said, well, if this St. Isidore school wins the case, then it may create momentum in various states not to have charter schools.
It could be.
It'd be sort of like the Blaine Amendment or something resurging.
Yeah. I mean, this is here.
That's horrible.
I mean, I think the question asked about vouchers and other types of educational savings accounts, those are clearly constitutional. The court has decided on those. This is not a legal opinion. I'm a big fan of just saying to every parent, here's $10,000 or $5,000 and direct it where you see fit. And Americans are wonderfully entrepreneurial people, and different things are good for different people and different kids. And I'm all about empowering parents. But that's a political view. That's not a legal view. But the new legal doctrines coming from the court, I think, are going to allow political communities to do that. Yep. And then different communities will do different things. And I mean, I think what happened during COVID was a travesty, but one of the good things that happened was different states could do different things and people could move with their feet. That's healthy, right?
I have another question here, and this might be our last question given time. There's a very well-referenced question here. Somebody pushing back saying, given a lot of the things that you were saying, isn't it a bit of a stretch to say that we're not a nation with a Christian founding? And here's some references. One, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Washington or Adams?
John Adams.
There we are, Adams. And they also say, you know, prayer sessions of founding fathers while writing the Constitution, and so on and so forth. So what's the distinction here? Why do you think we should say that Christianity was so important, but that we shouldn't quite say that it was a Christian founding, you get it.
I think it's more, let me give you maybe the clearest example. Many states at the time of the founding had religious restrictions on who could hold office. These restrictions took two forms. One, just like in the Constitution, like the 1780 Constitution of Massachusetts said, you must be Protestant to be the governor or a state senator. Many of the states had provisions like that. Or if the prohibitions or limitations were not in the state constitution, they were in the oath of office. For example, Delaware, I'm not going to get this exactly right, but to be governor or to be a state senator and governor, you had to take the oath of office. And the oath of office said something like, I believe in the Old and New Testament. So excluding Jews. And so these exclusions, I mean, these states, in a sense, this would be the strongest evidence from the founding that we're a Christian nation, that we states limited office holding to Christians. Sometimes Jews were included. Sometimes they limited office holding to Protestants. That is actually the best evidence from the founding for the Christian nation thesis. When it came to the Federal Constitution has a provision that says no religious tests for office. And it was criticized by some anti-federalists, those who were against guns, saying, you mean Catholics or Mohammedans, Muslims, they use the term Mohammed, Catholics or Mohammedans could hold, be president or be a senator, federal senator? And James Madison said, yes. If the people vote for a Catholic or a Mohammedan to be a member of the House of Representatives, if that's who they want, then yes, we will have no religious tests for office. I think Madison was right. And gradually those religious restrictions on holding office in the states evaporated. And in that fundamental sense, yes, we need to be a religious people if our country is going to work, right? But we don't have to limit rights and privileges only to Christians. And so that's how I understand. That's why I use the language of a country consonant needing religion, needing Christianity. But I don't want to say it's a Christian nation per se, because really that means excluding people, especially for office, based on religious tests.
I will say this. I think it's fair to say that had you not had the history of people seeking freedom, religious freedom, when they came to the U.S., you would not have ended up with the kind of government we had. And there's all the, you know, the sermons surrounding the founding and all that sort of thing. So had there not been the belief in unalienable rights from a creator, which is pretty much a Western tradition for sure, you wouldn't have had our government.
That's right. So let me just say one other thing, and then say if anyone else, happy to stay as long as you want to take questions. I went a little bit long in my remarks. The Declaration of Independence says our rights are endowed by our Creator. We have these natural rights, but one could ask. One student asked me recently, well, why should we respect nature? All men are created equal. Well, why should I respect that? And the foundational answer, why respect nature, is because God created the world and it was good.
I'd say, can that person say that that the world is flat and the... No. I mean, come on.
So that...
You're too nice.
That we are creatures of a creator. But that's not just a Christian sentiment. But that is, I think, the foundational belief on which our nation is based. And so that's what I think John Adams meant when he said this nation was made for religious and moral people. Thank you again.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you, Dr. Munoz. Thank you, Judge. This was a lot of fun. I'm just going to say one more thing. These are going to be available. This is going to be available on our website. It'll take a little bit for us to edit it and get it up there, but it'll be there if you want to share it with friends, students. It'll be a resource for you. And we're going to get last year's, just the audio, not the video, but we're going to get last year's one with Tom Holland up on the website as well. So stay tuned, be on the lookout. And this, we hope that this is going to be an educational resource, not just for St. Martin's, but schools, churches, or anybody who can make use of them. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you again for your speakers. Let's give them one more round.